Hello.
Yes, sir.
My name is Sue Eldridge, and I'm interviewing Ken Rowe, who worked at Caldwell's from 1946 to 1950, on Thursday the 31st of May, 2012. So thank you very much indeed, Ken, for agreeing to take part in these interviews.
Okay.
First of all then, would you mind telling me where you were born and when you were born?
Well, I was born in Timperley, Altrincham, which is not more than 2 miles from where we're sat now.
Right.
At the other end of Timperley. Yeah. And my parents moved quite a lot around Cheshire, and we ended up at this particular time in Poynton, near Stockport.
Yeah.
And I had a considerable amount of illness in young days. And my schooling was pretty sketchy because I was kept off for months and sometimes years at a time. But when I was born in 1931, and when I was roughly 8, we moved to Poynton. It was the start of the Second World War. And it was an interesting place because I was born, we'd moved around the more busy parts of Cheshire, but out in Poynton in those days was really out in the country. And, you know, a lot of market gardening and farming went on. I used to spend a lot of school holidays on farms and market gardens and so forth, earning a bit of extra money. And the area, of course, was interesting at the time because we were on the boundaries of Woodford Aerodrome, and all the testing of the... I met quite a lot of the people, test pilots and people that were involved and billeted in Poynton very often. Yes. And this was generally Lancaster bomber production, which was fascinating to me, but it irritated the local population because of the noise, but it was fascinating to me. But I was always interested in growing, and right from an early age I'd got my own piece of garden that I liked to fiddle with. And then because of illness, parents were advised that I should have an outdoor occupation, and much against my father's wishes, because he was an office worker, and to him being a gardener was the lowest of the low. So he didn't like the idea. Anyway, I had my school days, limited as they were, during the Second World War, towards the end of the Second World War, when I left school.
Can you just sort of, where did you actually go to school? Where did you end up
going? Oh, well, I went to school originally at Poynton, as a junior infant school in Poynton. And at the time of the 11 plus, I sat for a lot of the local grammar schools and secondary technical schools, as they were called in those days. I didn't get to a grammar school, but I got to what was Stockport School, which was classed as Stockport Secondary Technical School in those days, the tech as it was called in to the locals, which was a great moor between Stockport and Hazel Grove. And I used to ride my bike latterly, in the latter days. I was there for only just over 3 years, because I'd had so much illness. By the time I was 14, I was so behind, and I wanted to leave school then and start work. My father had started work at 13, and I started at 14, much to his disgust. and the headmasters discussed. But anyway,
was this all during the war or just at the end of the war?
This was the end of the war, really. Mm.
And what was it like, just before we go on to that, sort of, you enjoyed having the aerodrome nearby and things like that.
Mm.
What was it like then, so that growing up in the wartime?
Well, my parents were rather older than normal. All happened, of course, due to the First World War, that they were late in meeting, getting married. The original, my mother's original fiancé was killed on the Somme and all that. But it was, my father joined very late in life, really, but he joined the army again in the Second World War. So things were difficult because he'd had a reasonably good job in Manchester for most of his life in a shipping business, really. And originally, I think his interest he passed on to me in gardening was when he worked for a firm called seed firm who ended up in Timperley actually, but they used to have shops in seed shops in Manchester, and he dealt with a lot of the orders, so he picked up a lot of Latin names and also geography of where things were sent. But he joined the army, so I didn't see much of him during the war. He didn't go on the front line because he was too old. But at the end of the war, of course, when he returned to his previous occupation, as happened to a lot of people, the end of the war was worse. During the war, we managed for quite a while. There wasn't a lot of shortages, but towards the end of the war, things really got difficult. Rationing got more difficult. We didn't get bread rationing until after the Second World War. And my father's income was nothing like the people who'd been able to stay in civilian street. Everything was worn out, and the bedding was worn out, wanted replacing. And they were really in very straitened circumstances. And because after I left school, one of my ambitions was to go to Reesheath College and study horticulture, which was out of the question because of the fees.
Oh, what a shame.
Mm. My father, no way could he afford those fees. But then, of course, the question was, what would I do? And we were friendly. My mother had always had her vegetables from a local market gardener. And this chap, Herbert Stott, and his wife, they lived in the in a road adjacent to us in Poynton. And he had a market garden. He'd started this market garden. Actually, he'd started tomato growing in 1936. He had one of the biggest glasshouse areas in Cheshire, because tomato growing was fairly new then, particularly in the north of England. And he'd grown tomatoes more or less in those days. It was just tomatoes all the main season, and then they used to clear them out and put chrysanthemums in for the winter. And those two crops were all that he did, really, until he contracted a disease known as tomato asthma. and it was caused by a lot of the dust of the spores, cladosporium, which was a fungal infection of tomatoes, and you got terrible dust coming off them, particularly as you were clearing the old stems out in the autumn. So I did, as a 14-year-old, do a bit of helping him there. I remember I got 7 shillings and 6 pence a week because that was all he could afford to pay me. But he then sold out the tomato business because of his health and moved to just out an outdoor field. He had a very small greenhouse to raise seeds in, but he had 5 acres on the borders of, well, it was actually right on the borders of Poynton and Woodford, on the Woodford Aerodrome border, and which again was fascinating because we could see all these aircraft taking off and landing while we were working. And I worked for him for 2 or 3 years, and then I got interested in growing more particular herbaceous perennials and alpines and things. I became very friendly with a neighbour who was a member of the Alpine Garden Society, and he grew alpines in his garden. But also my mother had an uncle who was a Methodist. Well, he was a Congregational, as it was called, a minister in a place called Ainsdale near Southport. And the only place we ever went to for holidays in the 1930s. And he had this remarkable little garden in Ainsdale near Southport. Being a minister of the Congregational Church was not a wealthy occupation, but this garden was absolute treasure trove to me because he got it just full of raised frames, so he didn't have to bend. He was an old man, and he was in his 80s at the end of the war, but full of pots of alpines that you could see at eye level, and he got a remarkable collection. And of course, he told me about all the places he'd been to. But in those days, the only holidays he and Auntie Claire, his wife, got was 14 days in Switzerland. And that was the only break they got. But that was quite something to go abroad in those days. And they did it the hard way, third class on the train, probably stood up most of the way. He used to take a Gladstone bag, leather bag, packed with wet newspaper and moss, and a little trowel. And they used to go to, I think it was nearly always a place in Grindelwald, a cheap pension they knew, a pension as they call them. And he would tramp round Switzerland, that area of Switzerland. And to do things, of course, would be quite unacceptable today. But he did tell me that he picked seedlings out, and because he knew he was a botanist. He'd studied botany all his life, and I inherited all his books on botany, and I was very grateful for those when he died. But he said people went on holiday in those days, and they would rip up plants in full bloom to take them home. And he said there'd not a chance in hell that these things would grow. And that was destructive. But he said he was careful to take seedlings, not the parent plants. And he wasn't doing damage. But of course, because of what other people did, it became unacceptable. It was unallowed. And of course, they formed these alpine gardens where they restricted, well, they had to do because the whole place was being decimated, you know, regarding the alpine meadows are not like they were in the 20s and 30s because the plundering of those days. But that's what fired me growing and studying botany and horticulture was Uncle Fred Nichol, Reverend F.W. Nicholson. And I inherited all his old books. He'd got to the Alpine Gardener Society's bulletins for years, and right to the origins of it, I think. Because he'd been interested in alpines right to the turn of the last century, the 20th century. And he died in his 80s, as I say, in just about 1950, 51, something like that. Quite late 80s. He was interested in music as well, which is another interest of mine. Eventually, because I needed more than this 7 and 6 a week that I got from Herbert Stott. He was a very interesting character, actually. He only died recently. But Herbert Stott was referred to by a lot of people that I know in Cheshire, in Market Gardens, as the nearest man to God they'd ever come across, because he'd actually gave up work and followed Billy Graham for some years. He was an unworldly man. He'd never made any money. He inherited a lot of money. His father, when he was 21, his father left him enough money to have all those greenhouses built in Poynton. That's what he wanted to do. And buy a lot of things, including an Alvis car, which was very expensive in those days. And his parents' fortune came from Stotts of Oldham, who were manufacturers of fish and chip machines, actually. And his mother lived in a very big house and very gorgeous place in Cheadle-Hulme. And he and his sister, you know, lived a very privileged life as children. But he ended up in a council house at Poynton with absolutely nothing. But he'd given all his money away, mainly to the church. But he was a very kind man, a very saintly man, really. But not a businessman. And because I could see no future there at all as regards his business. And I had a few jobs in different little nurseries around Bramhall and Poynton, which, again, I couldn't see a lot of future in, but I'd set my sights on Caldwell's nurseries because they were famous those days.
So you already knew about them?
Yeah.
Yes.
But the problem was I lived in Poynton. Caldwell's was 13 miles away. I'd only a push bike, and I cycled over there, and they agreed to take me on the Rose Nursery at Ollerton in 1946, riding this...
16 then, I think, is that right?
Yeah, it's about that, yeah.
15?
I was 16, yeah, yes I was. Because, no, 17 was a car. 16, I could get a license for a motorcycle. At 15, I couldn't. So I was 15, But I was forbidden by my father to, you're not having a motorcycle. You're not having anything. That's the end of it. You'll only be found dead under some hedge or something on the way. Your mother will never get over it. So he wasn't going to lend me the money. But I stuck it for that winter, that first winter, cycling over there. And of course, we were digging most of the day. Sometimes I'd be cold, I'd be wet, soaking to the skin when I got there, and I'd be wet all day and then have to ride my bike home. And of course, strangely enough, in spite of my record as regards illness, I never even got a cold. I was worn out and fed up, but I wasn't cold. I wasn't ill over it. But a neighbour who was a nice elderly lady, a widow, in Point, and I used to help her with a garden at the weekend, with a bit of extra pocket money again. She said to me, I put this sad story to him, so she said, her brother was very keen on motorbikes, and she said, I'm sure he could help you, but she said, I'll lend you the money to buy an old one, and it was, we were talking about £30 in those days for a pre-war machine, a very old one, not a new machine. If you'll pay me back so much a week out of, and I think it was, you know, a matter of about 3 shillings and 6 pence, something like that, until when I got a bit of extra money, I increased it. Anyway, I did pay her back in quite record time, really, but her brother got me this old machine that you see on the photograph. And that was when, as soon as I was 16, I was able to use it to go to work on.
And your father was OK with that, was he?
He wasn't, no. No, he didn't speak to me for 6 months, but anyway, that's no, he was furious about it, but... And he couldn't understand why I wanted to be a gardener or work for a nursery. That's something you do for a hobby, but not for a living, you see. Anyway, yes, I worked there, 1950, and in some ways it was the most interesting time of my life, because in those days, it was a general nursery that you don't see today. Because of the war, they had to grow a certain amount of food.
Right, yes.
And everything, strangely enough, they'd got several nurseries around Knutsford. Right. Yes. The Rose Nursery was at Ollerton, where I started, and there'd a fruit nursery adjacent to it, there'd a herbaceous and shrub nursery in the centre of Knutsford itself, Telford Road, and there'd a tree nursery on Garden Road in Knutsford, which is now an estate, which they grow all the forest trees and that sort of thing. But the variety of plants, people specialise now, or garden centres don't do much growing, they buy in from specialist nurseries. But you don't get nurseries growing a bit of everything now. It's usually, you know, they're either herbaceous perennials, or they're rose nurseries, or, well, rose nurseries have not done very well over the last 20 odd years, because in the days when I started, even the smallest house, you know, have a little rose garden. Yeah, yeah. It's not done today somehow.
And that's where you started, was it, on the rose?
So I started on tying up was the original job for lads who had a bunch of raffia tied round your waist, and you followed the budders who used the budding knife and inserted the buds into the rose stocks. My first job, of course, was planting the briars. In those days, they used to buy. Well, they were able to get them at the end of the war from Holland. I don't know what happened during the war. Well, I do know what happened during the war. You couldn't get stuff from Holland, of course. But they got them before the war. And if you were a big importer from Holland in pre-war days, you got preferential treatment for importing as soon as the war ended. And of course the Dutch wanted to start the business again. And these seedling briars, which are Rosa canina, the dog rose briars. A lot of different stocks are used today, and I'm out of date, but that was the dog rose was the thing. And we planted these seedling briars from Holland as and when we were digging the field. So there was no tractor in sight when I first went there, or any mechanical means at all, other than a spade. And the whole line of men across a 3-acre field, say, and we would dig a trench and put the plants in and then dig back. And when we got so far, we'd put another row in. And it was all done by hand. So it was hard work, very, very hard. But he had, at the end, during the war, he had acquired a machine from George Monro, which were all big suppliers of horticultural machinery, called a row tracker, which I can show you a photograph of. And that was a killer, really. Broke two of my ribs at one stage, but it was a very crude machine which was very underpowered, and it was just a plough and the engine on the front in place of the horse, virtually, but, you know, a one horse plough. And of course, big heavy shafts in the front, and you had to physically manhandle this thing round to swing it round in on the headland to start another row, and you get cracked in the ribs with these as it would suddenly jerk, you know, and swing. It was not an easy thing, and you could break your arm swinging starting the engine if you weren't careful. So that was my introduction to horticultural machinery. The road track now would be quite a valuable antique, but it was cursed by all and sundry on the nursery in those days. But that was all we had, other than spades. And of course, there wasn't the manpower then, because a lot of the men were still awaiting demobilisation, or they got too old to work. They'd been working all through the war. And the man who's down here, this George Wilding, I don't know whether he's still alive, but he was one of the main budders who taught me to bud in Ollerton at that time. Because I used to go with other lads, we used to tie up the budding. Is that clear? Yeah. Tie up the stocks with raffia, and we had to follow each man. Who would, I think, if I remember rightly, but 300 to 400 a day, something like that. But several varieties, of course. There was a rose foreman who was Percy Allcroft, and he'd been a head gardener chauffeur gardener actually for a family called Green. And the Greens were the owners of the Refuge Assurance Company in Manchester, right, if you remember, which is now a hotel, you know, not Oxford Road. Yes, that was the Refuge. Mm. And the Greens, big family, Lady Proctor Green, there was a few members of the family had big houses in Knutsford. Right. Yes. But of course, they had to give up these gardeners because of the war effort. And he then got a job back at his old firm of Caldwell's, and he was there when I went there. And of course, it was his job to cut the wood off the stock plants and give them to the budders to take eyes and put them on, you know. And they used to get a certain amount of stock plants from different parts of the world each year. France was one of the leading places then for reintroduction of rose varieties. The Milan family had big nurseries in France, and they introduced a very famous rose called Peace.
Oh, yes.
And I was able to put some of the first buds in of that variety when it came in. And I think, if I remember rightly, it was sold at 7 and 6 a bush, where 5 shillings was the usual price for a rose tree in those days. So it was quite good. But it was very closely guarded because...
So very secret, you mean?
Very, very, yes. You know, people could make money by stealing wood, and which seems a bit silly today, really. There wasn't many people could actually propagate that way, but there was a relative who'd fallen out with the Caldwell, with the rest of the family, called Arthur, who lived in Orton, and he was reputed to sneak across in the dead of night in his dressing gown with a torch or a lamp and try and acquire these new varieties that his strange family had acquired. But the William, the head of the family was always William Caldwell all the way through the generations from 1780. And he'd always... anybody else had either got to be, they were subservient to William, the head of the family. And this particular man had decided he'd got a piece of land of his own that he'd inherited from his father, and he decided to go to war with it, with his cousin William. But it didn't work, but he was trying to establish a rival Caldwell's business across the road. But anyway, that was a bit of family rivalry.
I'll come back to the family in a minute.
Yeah.
But what about the budding then? So did you move on to that? You did your digging and you did your raffia.
I got on from tying up to being able to bud myself and having somebody else to tie up. But then I persuaded William, the old man's son, to allow me to do some work in the other branches, so that I wanted to learn about other plants, not just roses, you see. So I moved on to the herbaceous section, which was in the centre of the of Knutsford then, on Chelford Road. And also there was a lot of shrubs grown by Caldwell's in those days. And we're talking about really big specimens that cost a lot of money. The method of growing was interesting because there'd be big hollies 50 and 60 foot high that were able to be moved at any time. Well, always in the winter time, because that was the usual time. We used to have to dig a trench around them every year so that the roots were contained in a ball. And we used to get sacking round them if they were being sold. And gradually manoeuvre them onto a horse-drawn, it was a horse-drawn flat truck. The lorries they had, the two delivery trucks called us, which I don't think were more than 3 tonners, and they wouldn't take a 60-foot. It had to be taken on the horse-drawn wagon. And they were local deliveries, these, unless they went to the station and were put on a train. But we're talking that then, when the a lot of houses in Mere had been built, and a lot of celebrities we had coming onto the nursery, of course, which was very interesting then, who wanted a large tree to obscure a telegraph pole straight away. You know, they wanted the an instant obstruction of the view. And one particular person, of course, was George Formby and his wife, Beryl, and she was very insistent on big trees to screen the place. And they had a landscape department, of course, who they used to go around laying out these gardens. So I wasn't involved in those days, but I used to be sent with other gangs of men to plant some of these bigger shrubs and trees in the big houses in Mere and Great Budworth, all the surrounding areas. But it was very interesting on that side of it, because in the main nursery where we near the offices, of course, is where they dealt with these people who were local customers, and there was a very great upstairs and downstairs element then. Of course, you know, it was, looking back at it now, it was unbelievable. You know, how certain people would treat you most disrespectfully, really, and treat Mr. Caldwell most disrespectfully. Oh, yes, yes. There was a lot of big businesses. Families had moved out to Knutsford, as all these Hale and so forth. And a lot of them were, what we would say today, very jumped up, really. I found in those days the very well-established old aristocratic people who had money all their life were charming to deal with. But some of these who made great wealth in a short length of time were absolutely impossible. Absolutely impossible. I mean, I don't think people use Miller's baking powder now, but whether you've heard of it, but it was a famous thing, like beer oat flour and Bovril and things that were famous in the old days. I mean, Mrs. Miller would come down to the nursery, only a few hundred yards actually from where she lived, in a car. She had a chauffeur, but she would sometimes drive. And you could tell by the sound of the car that she didn't know what she was doing. And she would pull up outside in Chelford Road, right in the middle of the road, obstructing the road. And I asked one of the men, or the elderly men on the nursery, I said, why don't the police move her on? You know, she'd been wandering around the nursery. Ooh, they daren't. She's Mrs. Miller. And she would walk up, Caldwell! And this is how she addressed Mr. Caldwell, our boss. And she talked to the lights, was a boy, come here, and all this sort of thing. You wouldn't dare talk to a coloured person like that. Well, there wasn't any coloured people there, but you know, it was that very, very, well, a very disrespectful way of treating people. But you were just less than the dirt because you were in trade, a worker. And there was a great contrast. What was so amazing, really, was, of course, old Mr. Caldwell, he was extremely subservient and would bow and scrape to these people and pander to their wishes because that was his business. And I happened to be asked to man the shop. There was nobody in for some reason or other. I was working on that nursery in the centre of the town, not on Telford Road anyway, and where they sold those knives. And I'd gone into the shop to hold the fort till Mr. Caldwell came back. The old man had gone out for some reason or other. And while I stood in the shop, this colossal Rolls Royce pulled up. And it wasn't, you could tell it was, it was very old, even by those standards. It was probably pre-World War I. The bonnet went from, here to the middle of next week. And it certainly wasn't very smart. It was a very ancient Rolls Royce. Well, this old man got out, who I assumed was a gardener for somebody, and shuffled into the shop. He'd got an old cloth cap, which was got bits of stuff in, it was got torn on some briars or something. And he shuffled into the shop, and good morning, young man. I could tell he was some quality when, as soon as he spoke, I require a pruning knife, not a big, Yes, certainly, sir. I'll show you what we've got. So I showed him the array of stuff we'd got in there. Oh, that's excellent. Yes. So, yes, I'll take that, young man. Thank you very much. And he was most charming. We mentioned the weather or something. He was chatting away to me and gave me the cash. And as he was about to leave, the old man returned, Mr. Caldwell, So he came out from the back of the shop and practically fell on the floor. Good morning, my lord. Good morning, my lord, Bowing, I thought, good God, what on earth's going on here? I just didn't understand. I'd never met him before. So, nice to see him. Yes. Good morning, Caldwell. Anyway, out he went. He treated me with more respect than he treated. So out he went, toddled into his Rolls Royce. And this was Lord Edgerton of Tatton, Maurice Edgerton. And young man, boy or something, this is Caldwell. Mr. Caldwell, he said, do you know who you were talking to? I said, I've no idea. That was Lord Edgerton of Town. I said, well, thank you for telling me, but I didn't know. Well, you'll remember in future, won't you, to give him some respect? I said, I wasn't rude to him, sir. Anyway, I saw him on one or two occasions. He was always pleasant, always nice. And there was people like that. There was the man who was the local MP, actually, because it was known as the Knutsford Division then. It's altered now. But the Knutsford Division covered quite a big area of Cheshire. And Lieutenant Colonel Sir Walter Bramley Davenport, Bart, at Capethorne Hall, was the MP. And he had an American wife that was a charming lady, actually. But he could be a bit autocratic. And as I didn't know who he was, he appeared on the Rose Nursery at one stage with his wife. And they wanted half a dozen roses for Capethorne Hall. He wasn't going to deal with me. He wanted me. Where's Mr. Caldwell? So anyway, the boss, the foreman had to send on, get on the telephone to get Mr. Caldwell personally to come down, you know. And I said to him, I said, who shall I see? You know, he said, I require a return to come and see me. He said, tell him it's Lieutenant Colonel Sir Walter Brumley Davenport Bart. He gave his full title like that, you know, and it was just, the attitude.
Yes, gosh.
He did come on the nursery on another occasion, well, more than one, not speaking to me personally, but with his wife. And I'd always been interested in music, but I'd been to a concert with a friend of mine in the Free Trade Hall in Manchester. And for some reason that I was whistling something while I was working. I wasn't serving anybody. I was budding roses, and hobbing and whistling. Boy, what's that? What are you whistling? So I told him what it was, and it was a theme of Beethoven's. Where have you heard that? I said, I was at a concert, so, you know. So he walked away and he turned to his wife. He said, good God almighty, what next? You know, these peasants going to concerts. Yeah, oh yes, they thought it was just amazing.
Goodness.
Yeah, you wouldn't talk like that, would you, today?
No.
But that was the attitude, you see.
Crikey.
He wasn't nasty to me or rude, but he was just, you're not in your place, boy. You're getting too big for your shoes, attitude, you know. Mm. You know, they're educated, these people, and, you know. Mm. And old man Caldwell said the older man, you know, the William Senior, said to one of the customers, one of the big customers came in at the time of a general election, it was then, and I think it was at the time the first Labour government got in, it was after the war, and of course they were very keen that Churchill should get in. And Bromley Davenport was going round, you know. And of course, it was a very Tory area. There was no question that he wouldn't get in. But I overheard this, and I think it was Mrs. Miller, but one of the customers, Caldwell, I hope all your men are going to vote Tory. I hope you're going to insist. So he said, you know, these days, Mrs. Zantho, the trouble is they've got minds of their own, you know, they've been in the army, and, you know, I'm short of labour, you can't tell them what to do like you used to be able to do. She says, well, you should do, you should sack the lot of them. If they're not going to vote for our people, then sack the bloody lot of them. Yeah, that was her attitude.
Amazing.
Yes.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. But it was interesting because you saw a cross-section of society that I'd never come across before.
Of course, yes.
It was unbelievable, really. Yes. So, where are we now?
Tell me about that nursery then, because you said you went there to deal with big, different variety of plants. Didn't you?
Oh yeah, great variety. Yes.
Tell me about the nursery and the shop then, because you mentioned hollies, but what other sorts of things were you growing there?
Well, as in, there was a variety of, all the herbaceous plants were grown there in beds where we used to, plant young stock and then dig up for dispatch later on. In those days, the shrubs, not the small plants, but all the shrubs and the trees, and it applied to the fruit trees and rose trees, you or any customer could come and select one and put, and you'd ask them to put a label with your name on it so that it could be dispatched at the right time of the year, which there was nothing containerized like there is today. It was all dug up October, October, November, yeah. And it could be labelled, or they might just give an order, they decide they like a certain thing, and then it would be entered into the order book for delivery. And in the autumn, of course, there's a big going round with that trolley on, showing on the photo, where we collected all these plants up and sent them for dispatch. And of course, in those days, the dispatch from all the nurseries was mainly by rail. There wasn't a lot. The only deliveries were by the local van in the area, but otherwise they were sent by rail.
Does that mean you were covering a very wide geographical area? Actually, your customers came from...
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Well, as even with the old book, you probably know about the old book of old nurserymen. Caldwell's were dealing with London nurseries. They were dealing wholesale all over the country and Scotland, even in the early 1800s, you know. And of course, once rail services started, there was a big, very big increase in trade between nurseries. It wasn't all local because they could transport them. And there was a huge packing shed and with a bench down one side and pegs, which were 6-inch nails, I think, all the way down, and there would be a certain length of jute string hung on these pegs, and straw was brought in. Bales of straw were always brought in from local farms, and the straw was then laid on the packers. There was about 5 or 6 men employed just on packing in the winter time and dispatch. They put the straw on them, and then the tree, and then more straw. Sometimes there'd be wet moss around the roots, and then they'd tie them up with these cords that were on the pegs along the bench. And the thing was all tied up in a pyramid of straw, and that was ready to go on one of the either the horse-drawn lorry or the motor lorry down to Knutsford Station. And all these stations, hail used to be full of things from Clybrands of Altrincham, plants from them. They'd all be full of plants in those days in the winter for dispatch all over the country.
Goodness.
By rail, yeah.
Thank you. And what sort of things? Can you just describe some of the sorts of things that were dispatched from the nursery you were working in?
Well, alpines and small herbaceous, you know, which had, of course, all died down, were just roots. We usually packed in wet newspaper and moss and in little wooden boxes for each order. Or very strong cardboard, depending on the size or the amount of the plants. And they would be sent by, pardon me, post or rail. I'm going to have to get a drink of water, I think. Yeah, excuse me.